Sorry. That's a personal moment. Hey, so I guess we're going to get going. Thank you. I know people are coming in a tiny bit later, but come on in, make yourself at home. If you think you're here for the Following the Money panel, you're in the right place. If you think it's the Following the Coal panel or the Following the Ocean Degradation panel, it's somewhere over on the other side, but they're all connected. So, very nice to see you all. And we're going to actually have an interesting discussion today about international investigations and international collaborative investigations and investigations that rely deeply on data sources also that are being unearthed by inventive journalists like the ones on this panel. So, quickly, I'm Mark in this arena, and am really proud to be actually up here sort of highlighting the work of these three journalists. It says here UC Berkeley. I'm not exactly representative of UC Berkeley. I do teach one class there a year in Earth Journalism, and otherwise I write books and magazine articles and such. And I'm mentioning this now because I want to introduce our panel right now, but basically, just to give you a sense of context, 30 years ago, it was about 30 years ago, I was asked, I was a little younger than I am now, I was asked by The Nation magazine to go to Europe and set up an international investigative network. And that network had never existed before in terms of doing investigative reporting. And it was a brief period when The Nation actually had some money. So they sent me to Paris, and my job was actually to find and recruit writers who wrote for different, in this case it was European publications, who could collaborate with one another across national frontiers and thereby do investigative journalism that would then get published in all these publications. In this case, it was across Europe and, of course, in The Nation. We had a special produced a whole bunch of stories over the subsequent years. I was the editor of that enterprise. And by the way, it was kind of pre-email, so it was a lot of time spent on the phone and fax and trying to track people down. But we did it. And it was at that time that we kind of introduced this idea of kind of trying to do transnational investigations. That later gave rise, helpfully, to the GIJN, which some of you might be familiar with, Global Investigative Journalism Network. So now here we are 30 years later. I am so moved by, what's happening overall in the world of journalism in terms of the collaborations are the new norm as opposed to a very unusual back in that day when I was trying to put that together. And so we've seen this approach, number one, of international journalists working together across national frontiers to come up with stories that can be shared, coming to a really fantastic fruition. At the same time, people have become more and more and more sophisticated in utilizing and databases that actually, in some cases, follow the objects, such as leather and trees, that operate in this kind of illicit international world. So these three stories that are authors of some recent blockbuster stories that utilize. I'm going to introduce them to you each if you haven't read it already. And then we're going to open up Andreoni, who comes here comes straight from Rio de Janeiro to our Houston conference. She has authored a major investigation for the New York Times Magazine, which she will. The New York Times that she's going to tell you about. And she's a fellow at the Pulitzer Center Rainforest Investigations Network, which all of you should know about because they help sponsor very cool Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, which is a project I've followed really close. It does amazing work. You guys should be aware of it. It's often known as OCCR. Sasha's been doing a lot of work in Latin America. She was involved in the Pandora Paper investigations, which all of you should be familiar with. And she's now working with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in D.C., and then providing, you know, has been one of the leading institutions that has been going through and interpreting and then providing us insights based on these Pandora Pandora papers. So, and has done an extraordinary story on how a chemical company CEO laundered his profits. So I'm going to turn it over to each of them to give you a little bit brief rundown of their stories. Then we will. I'll probably have a couple questions, and we're going to kick it over to you and make this turn this into a nice discussion. So,
hi, thank you so much. Coming from Brazil, our story shows how cattle raised in illegally deforested areas in the Amazon rainforest were used to produce leather that, through a very complex supply chain, becomes leather seats in some in cars sold by one that we visited. So this ranch is unable to stop this, and so these farmers are able through very simple techniques are able to have investigation agency, which is a nonprofit in Washington, because they had access to the one bit of the supply chain which isn't easy to find because it used to be public record but isn't anymore, which is cattle movement data. Basically, data from the Brazilian government that shows where cattle moving from one farm to the other. So they had gotten hold of this data and thought we could connect it to major auto companies in the U.S. So what we did was get this data to show that the illegal cattle ranches in this slaughterhouses in Amazon were moving and then from those that makes car parts in the U.S. and Mexico, and then from Lear we saw that companies. So I just wanted to tell you first about like how you start a story like this, a supply chain story. One really good place to start is just looking at shipping data. Which, you know, this is Panjiva. If you are with the publication, they will give you an account for free. Just also start Comtrade UN, which is a way to give you ideas, like if you're interested in timber or use data mine, which is not free. We had to pay for that. But it also, like, shows trucks, which is very rare, like trucks going from Mexico to the U.S. because a part of our supply chain was in Mexico. So I think this is from, like, once we established that this trade is happening, we want to go, like, to the start of the supply chain, which is the cattle movement. Brazil, and I know today in massive lines, but it means there are lots of farms. And, you know, farms are sometimes a reporter's best friend. And these farms mean that are farms of vaccination, a cattle vaccination, because Brazil does have to show the world that its cattle is healthy. So they have to vaccinate all cattle, including cattle that is in illegal areas. So once farmers put information to this farm, it goes into a database. And from there on, from then on, before it became restricted, in the Amazon. So this is where it all starts, and I think, you know, this can also be done with timber. We also have farms for. The next thing is corporate websites. This is JBS's website, like JBS. It doesn't, but the bit that it does track, to see, you can see there on the bottom right, that they were displaying information about the farms and the location of the farms they were buying cattle from. So we were able to get this information from the back end of their website. We have information in SEC documents. We've had people in our Rainforest Investigations Network to find very important supply chain information in SEC filings and filings from, like, other countries' SEC. So it's very good to try and find those websites. And I also wanted to show you like some databases that I think are helpful. The Amazon is vast and complicated, but there's a lot of data about the Amazon that the Brazilian government issues, and a lot of this data is in English and downloaded in shapefiles. So we use this, like the location data from the JBS website, to understand like what was the perimeter of each farm, and then from then on we can use deforestation data to figure out like if they were illegally deforested or not, if they overlapped a protected area where that would make it illegal and all. And things like that. You can download this data. It's kind of annoying to download, but maybe worth it, depending on what you... The Brazilian government, Terra Brasilis, which shows deforestation and fires through information and you know, see historically, see it by indigenous land, by state, whatever you want. Yeah, it's also free, good one to know. This is... Map Biomas, that you can download from there. Countries in the Amazon Basin, like Colombia and Peru, a good one to try too. And the last thing we did when all else failed is that we followed the trucks. You know, like chain are always going to be a little bit mysterious. For us, it was the bit between the slaughterhouse and the tanneries. We knew from sources that this was happening, but we weren't totally sure. And fraud also suspected that some of the paperwork from that cow legal farm, but actually came from an illegal farm. So we were able to follow the truck, and then we followed it to a major slaughterhouse. It was funny because we told the company, and they filed the police report saying, oh, this was illegal. We knew nothing about this. By the slaughterhouse to wait. We had all the supply chain all checked out. So anyway, if you have questions, if you want to email me, that's my email address. And that's it.
Thank you. ...into illegal logging in Nicaragua. Why it's the most dangerous place to be. Environmental defender. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks, Mark. And thanks, everyone, for coming to our panel today. So this is a very different investigation into deforestation and corruption reporting project, or OCCRP. And it was based on a leak of more than 18,000 Forestal, or INAFOR. So I'm going to be referring to it as INAFOR going forward. To put these documents in context, one of the first things we turned to was public data. And that is that according to the United Nations world, that doesn't mean that it's losing the most forests. And if you can see on that map there, it's losing its forests on the order of 5 to 10 times faster than Brazil and Indonesia. Another key clue from the data came from looking at satellite data. And particularly, this is data from Global Forest Watch. And what that showed us is that in the red areas you see there near the Atlantic coast, and those are indigenous lands. Particularly, they're the indigenous autonomous zones in Nicaragua's south and north, and they're supposed to be the federal government, significant degree of independence from the federal government. They actually include, in the north, the Bosawas Biosphere Reserve, which has the second largest tropical forest in the Americas behind the Amazon. I'm going to go into specifics. Is that corruption was a key factor that was driving deforestation in Nicaragua. Mostly when you hear about Nicaragua, if you do at all, it's about Daniel Ortega, who's the autocratic leader there, who's engaged in very serious human rights abuses and repression in the last few years. But what we wanted to understand is how his government's policies were contributing to these sky-high deforestation rates and what the documents we obtained could tell us. Electricity company called Enatrel. We looked at the data and looked at who was getting the most permits to cut down forests of any organization, and this was the one that we found. And you see right there. What we did find, though, is that it turns out that Enatrel is specifically that it's funneled over $500,000 to companies that are controlled by two of the children of Daniel Ortega and his wife, Rosario Murillo, who's the vice president and first lady of Nicaragua. She's also known as the de facto co-president of Nicaragua. By the year, figure out exactly what was really happening with all these permits that were going to approval of these permits by INAFOR. And it showed us the bigger issue that we discovered was that essentially governance in Nicaragua and governance by INAFOR was being subverted to this person. The key story that we looked at was our efforts to understand what was actually happening in the indigenous areas where the forests were being funding a guy named Osorno Coleman. Osorno Coleman is a member of Zone, and he's one of the most armies, known as Comandante Blas. As a little refresher on Nicaraguan, him, the U.S. and the CIA to do so at the time. It was a big Cold War proxy battle. And it was legally sold arms here for the Iran-Contra scandal, in which the Reagan administration illegally sold arms to Iran to fund the Contras. Now, how important is Osorno Coleman in all of this geopolitical senior? This was a picture that Osorno Coleman had posted on his Facebook page. And as you could see, it's inscribed at the bottom, to Comandante Blas, with best wishes, and signed by George's political career as a defender of the Miskito people and as this fierce opponent of Ortega and the Sandinistas. And he runs for Congress in a political alliance with the Sandinistas and joins their congressional bloc. And we wondered, what the heck is going on there? And why would this guy do this? He had even charged Ortega with genocide against the Miskito people at one time. What we found out is that Osorno Coleman secretly held shares in a forestry company called Vita Group International that was tapping pine trees in Osorno Coleman's congressional district and selling the resin abroad. And this is a picture of what that looks like. You scratch off the bark of the pine trees and essentially bleed the resin out of it into these bags, which are then sold for export. And people in the community told us that it did significant damage to the forests there. Now, in order to do that practice, you need permits from INAFOR. And Nicaragua's constitution says that if you're a Congress member, you can't be making money from dealings with the government. So experts said that Osorno Coleman's secret deal with Vita Group International was illegal. But it wasn't just... And here you could see what it looks like when the resin is put into bags and put on trucks where it's then shipped out of the country. What we found from these leaked documents of resin that it was allowed to extract from the northern indigenous zones, but when INAFOR tried to stop it, Rosario Murillo, the vice president, and the National Assembly speaker personally intervened to overrule INAFOR and allow these exports to be approved. To put that in perspective, Murillo was a member of Congress from a swing state. I mean, he was on their side in Congress, extracting more than he is allowed to from the autonomous indigenous zones. That, to me, most clearly embodied why Nicaragua has the highest rates of deforestation in the world. And I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you, Sasha. And, now we're going to go with Scylla Alechi.
Hi, everyone. So I work with the ICIJ. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but we are based in Washington. And in the past 10 years, we've been exposing an investigation called Pandora Papers. And the story that I'm talking to you today about today is part of that project. About 2 years ago, ICIJ received around the world that set up shell companies and trusts for in tax havens for ultra-wealthy people. These people are criminals, but they're also politicians or just corporate executives. I have done in the past a story about how chemical companies received these documents to see whether we could find any lead related to that issue in this trove. So found a list of the major chemical companies in the world and tried to see whether we had relevant documents. There were millions of false positives. In the end, after a lot of research, I found interesting leads about this company. It was set up, was founded, and maybe they, you know, the Solvay conferences where Albert Einstein attended. What is interesting about this cause is that it's very peculiar because basically a lot of the descendants are now part of the are now the largest shareholders. So it's basically a family-run company. A little bit. One of the interesting things that I found as I was researching this company was their old motto. So that piqued my interest. The other thing that piqued my interest was that it was trying to compete with DuPont in producing Teflon-like products that we know now that because of people. So I started to look into these documents, and initially I wanted to understand what's known and what's not, because of some information. So I made myself familiar with the Belgian equivalent of the SEC. In 2016, if I'm not wrong, they could not archive information about the trading of these managers. This is a screenshot of the FSMA website where you can look up what these company executives trade, but there is a limit. For example, if I did it like 2 days ago and it was dating back to 2020. And our data was starting in 2009. So there was no So I thought that was interesting because, as you see on the right hand, that was one of the documents that we had in the list. So if you don't know anything, there is the Solvay CFO. In the U.S., you should have a Form 4, I think, where you can see if a manager buys or trades stock of his own company or her own companies using a shell company or a trust. That's not like that in Europe. There is a form, but it's not publicly available. So there was a lot of uncertainty about what these guys were doing. So I thought I could go on and investigate this. This is one of the documents that I found. His name is Bernard de la Guiche, and his family trusts. Be the operating company in the British Virgin Islands. These companies were buying Solvay stock, and the trusts were based initially in New Zealand and then later in Singapore. Two trust havens, tax havens in a tax haven, and the BVI in another tax haven. Basically, he could benefit in a legal way, and I want to underline that, from the tax arrangements of those countries. Another thing that piqued my interest in the data was this email, where basically the managers, the family financial advisor, were discussing in 2009 to Singapore. So I started to look into this 2009 timeline because I wanted to know why in 2009 those moves at that time. And I realized two things. First, in 2009, because of the financial crisis, Swiss, foreigners' money, in this case, Americans' money. Second, there was a criminal case undergoing in Italy that saw Bernard de la Guiche, the top executive, as a criminal, as a defendant in the case. And that was quite extraordinary because usually you don't see an individual executive being named as a defendant in a lawsuit. You usually see the company being named. And I thought it was interesting because as I built a timeline of the financial documents and the news as well as what was going on in the real world, I found out that he and his family were actually moving more than $50 million outside of Switzerland into these secret havens around the time. So I went to this little town because, you know, whenever you have these financial documents, it sounds very exciting, but these are Bernard de la Guiche, I've never met him. They are very boring. who are you to find information about him? So I wanted to give, to understand, you know, to see with my own eyes what was the impact of his decisions, his family's financial decisions on his company. 2 hours from Milano. I'm from Italy. I'm from Rome, so I traveled there. It was pandemic, full second wave, lockdown, but there was nobody around. It was quite creepy. But it was very interesting to see. And this this is part of the plant that now makes PFAS, basically, chemicals. The plant has been around for 100 years, knows about it. These two photos at the bottom, the whole town knows about it. These two photos at the bottom are this yellow powder that the case started. And that's hexavalent chromium. And for anyone who knows Erin Brockovich, knows how dangerous that is. So as I learned about this criminal case, I also I got in touch with the lawyers who were interested in that case, because even if it was criminal, there is a provision in Italian law that allows civil parts to be part of it. So there were many dozens of people and workers who were part of my story, because as I met the lawyer who was part of this suit, he gave me this hard drive with about 20 folders. Eckers told me that he was the one, he knew that the plants were contaminated. Authorities investigating that. The court records also included a lot of documents about the cover-up. So all this basically created a great context for me just to understand the, you know, his role and why it was important that he was actually moving money around the same time that he was being investigated. For me, it was more like a David versus Goliath reason to continue to this town. And I saw that if you see on the left hand, that's the wall of the factory, the plant. On the right, that is one house. People really live. It was a well, a street from the plant. Up until the criminal case started, there was a well coming from, taking water from beneath the plant that was giving water to the veggie gardens of these people. So at town, you see the Solvay flag right in the dead center of the town, and everyone is depending on that. It's a community of workers, the same you have here in the U.S. in many towns, that basically depend on one facility. And that's why many people didn't want to, because at the same time that this the company was in, causing pollution in Italy, it was the same thing was happening in New Jersey. And finally, important part of the story and this for reporting the yellow hexavalent chromium that you saw, but he was time. He did not want to show his face. I made a short documentary also, and he did not want to show his face, as well as other workers didn't want to appear. Case that they, being a small close community, they're still fearing, like, 15 years after the case, that they wouldn't find a job afterwards. The second one is a boy. His mom was mentioned in the court case, in the court records, because she testified as a person who feared he was living as being had gotten sick with leukemia because he was living a few meters from the plant. And then finally, Mr. De La Guiche, who denied moving money for because of the criminal case, but he didn't explain why he didn't move the money. And that photo is from a Brazilian magazine, because he actually then moved to Brazil, where he has a great... I must say that. he's living a great life. I must say that one day, after he responded to our questions, he resigned from the board. Thank you.
Wow.
And also of Solvay's parent company, Solvac.
Thank you so much. And I have to say, Solvay factory. I was like, I think I know more about that company now. I also want to open it up to you, and if you have questions... ask them, or I'll ask them if you get them. But yeah, that. Can you speak up to
research companies that are active in Texas, like Solvay, in Europe? Have run into this issue of privacy. Has that gotten any better? The only thing I could find years ago when I was researching refinery deaths in Europe was really in England, where there was some great, in the UK, where there was something kind of like OSHA, or if you get reports online. How many European countries have these days?
Each country has can apply it with that country's legislation, regulation. But OSHA, for sure, it exists. The problem is that in many countries, for example, in Italy, you don't have online records. You have to talk to people, and then they will talk to you usually. But also knew the system and the language, for example. That my advice for you, because I know that it's very complex, I would suggest you get in touch with a reporter from that country who can kind of guide you through the system.
Yes, woman in blue and then behind you.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Hogue with Chemical and Engineering News, and Salve is on my on my radar too. So part of this, either in Italy or in New Jersey.
In Italy, it was not, because this lawsuit started maybe 15 years ago. No, 2011, so yeah, 10 years ago. And no, at the time, PFAS was not part of it, because basically the cleanup hasn't finished, and the same flawed system that was releasing chromium, now is releasing PFAS. In New Jersey, yes, the litigation involved PFAS.
And the woman? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here on the record because, so I'm kind of looking at, I love you all three of you kind of approach a story. If you get a lead, if you get some sort of financial document, we can't give people to confirm anything or go on record or only provide that information.
Yeah, Sasha, do you want to give that a go?
Independent media and on political opposition of all kinds by Daniel Ortega at the time we did our project. The key source that we found for the Vita Group was a court record from the United States who got into a legal dispute with each other in California, one of whom got kicked out of the company and turned out to be very eager to tell me. The larger lesson is that pretty much court records are one of the most valuable resources you can find, and even companies that are operating outside of the United States will often have some kind of link, whether it's a subsidiary or investors or some connections. And so I think one thing to look for is to put the name of the company into PACER, into a state court system, even Google it, and try to see if you can find court records, ideally in the United States or even in another country in which you might need some translation help.
Manuel, do you want to add anything to that?
Information about companies daily in their gazettes, so I encourage also you to, in that country, find a gazette, find someone who understands how this information gets published. One other thing that helped me was sometimes the government won't release information about a company, but if you can confirm certain details, it will help you confirm the whole thing. FOIA requests, just to confirm the non-sealed details of documents, because that gave us confidence that the rest was correct.
And just to build on that, I just wanted to ask, putting the piece, beef into these canneries, and that was kind of quite a revelation, quite a way to actually open a story. So maybe you can reflect on what you did to get this guy to tell you essentially what your story was investigating, and if other of you have comments on this question, because part of it is the people out there that are doing things, they can confirm things, but you have to find a way to approach them. Any thoughts?
Yeah, you were very lucky, but also, like, when you're reporting in places where there aren't many journalists, people are not
very, you know, they're not media trained. They don't, they're not as suspicious of doing things illegally for over a decade. No one has ever come after him. So, like, his sense of being above the law was very strong. And he didn't see from the start, like I said, this is what I'm doing. And yeah, he didn't like the story at the end. and nothing happened to him, by the way. He's still there. In the end, his fellow partners.
Any other thoughts from either of you about getting people to, of somebody, of an employee down on their knees trying to discovering this chemical, making it kind of real for everybody, for all readers? Suddenly we could, before we knew, most of us hadn't heard of Solvay, most of us certainly had never heard of this guy. And just tell us your thinking in this regard.
So for the worker, I got in touch with a lawyer, with this guy, who had by that time moved with his meeting to do with it, and I went to see him, the most important one, and I wanted to say something about the executives, because usually they don't talk. In this case, the most difficult part was to find an email for these guys, because, you know, they're not on Facebook. And we had some, so that's the report. For the others, we sent mail, like letters, physical letters. One guy that turned out to be helpful because he received actually the letter. So, you know, it's weird, but emails are not enough these days.
And Sasha, how about you? You were operating in a very, very different environment. Versus, just tell us a little bit about how you got people to talk.
So I guess two points I would make. One was that people in Managua, sort of within a record, but indigenous leaders and community members, almost like they had nothing to lose, that they had been open for years about how abusive the government had been towards them and their land rights. So I think one lesson from that is that if there are groups and populations who are very marginalized and mistreated, even in an oppressive system and an oppressive country, they may be more willing to talk to you than people who have something to lose. I also spoke, I had a pretty lengthy interview with the Sorno Coleman himself, the Congressman Comandante Blas, and the way that I opened that, so I sent him, you know, I got his contact information, I sent him a WhatsApp message saying, asking him, tell me about what it was like being Comandante Blas. And once he got started talking, he was off. And so I think the point I would take from that is, even if someone is a subject of your investigation, you know, don't pretend or mislead them, but that there's a way of approaching them in which you can put them in the mindset to...
I know this gentleman had his hand up earlier, man.
Piecing together greenhouse gas emissions of supplies of data of people who can put that together.
Wow, interesting question.
I mean, in Italy, there's an official count. I mean, I could name some researchers who I think like could talk with that. But in terms of like how much you're carrying and stuff, like to another country,
You can look up not just the forest associated with that forest loss, and that's based on, you know, formulas that are used. And so I think it's sort of a science in progress. But there is increasing capacity for deforestation, at least, to cross.
And I would add, just from my own reporting, I think there's actually interesting sources in the realm. Each city, at least the United States, as we know in many other places, for example, Brazil and Italy and other places representative, are pursuing greenhouse gas strategies. Often they have a greenhouse gas system, but to analyze how much greenhouse gases their residents are responsible for when it comes to the things that they consume. And you can actually get very interesting data on the consumption patterns of people within cities. That you could find it also if you do a... Yes.
So from what I understand, connections, personal connections in journalism and subjects are extremely important, especially in investigative journalism. I'm curious how you folks have been able to build personal connections with subjects and people who give you background information, as well as people like translators and people on the ground who can trust both you, so they trust you and you trust them to keep you safe.
Excellent question. Who would like to take it?
Well, I must say that I'm usually very jealous of big reporters who are on a beat for many years and who really have sources and people that can help them even give them tips. For what I do, for example, many times I do something new every year, and so it's difficult to build like a network of sources. But because the project that I usually work on lasts for many months, I have the time to establish some sort of rapport with those people. So I just see them if I can.
Preparation is helpful. Yeah.
I just think that be open about what you're doing and like talk to as many people as possible. And you know, very often you'll find people who really want to help you. And like Sasha said, a lot of people on the front lines of like deforestation have very little to lose, and they're really looking for someone to give them a voice.
Actually, Rosario Murillo herself wrote this response to me that was something like, "Thank you, brother, we will get back to you." But then she never did. For this story in Nicaragua, the reporting on the ground was done by Nicaraguan reporters. So I spoke to a number of people by phone in Nicaragua, but I wasn't on the ground. The main thing for me is to try to really assess what the pros and cons and the risks of the situation are, as well as the credibility of the threats. I know that's pretty general. I guess that a specific threat, that a vague one, I also would want to feel that I could trust the person who I would be taking the risk for and who would be my guide in doing so, and that if I felt that something was essential for a story, that I trusted the person, more likely to reconsider.
His partner then, in the middle of the conversation, realized, I didn't feel like I was threatened because the guy invited me. I think, you know, when you're going to a date, you realize that this story might not be positive. His friend, he said, "Oh, so you might have problems here." So that's when we're like, "Oh, okay." So we packed and left city immediately. You know, like you just, like Sasha said, I didn't think it was credible, but before you, Briscoe was careful like not to let him speak too much to anyone because he stays there. I think when you, as much as you can do yourself, people have your number, not their number. People see your face, not their face. Think that they're just assisting you. That's the best thing because you have to, sometimes, like this guy was helping me, he wasn't very aware of this, you know, like he wanted to help. But it's very important that you understand that it's your job to protect the local people helping you.
Advice for folks who work in smaller newsrooms that cover smaller geographic areas, like day-to-day reporting, assuming they don't have a lot of time or a big team.
Really localizing your report.
In my presentation, there's information there, very granular information. So I think using data when you can't go, you try to learn a little bit about QGIS, which is a geoprocessing, like get a sense of what's happening without needing to go there. And how things are changing can really help you like get a sense of what's happening without needing to go there. And you know, even have before and after pictures for your day story, you know. So I think that might help.
Okay, we have time for one more question. And can you make it really fast if it's just a quick follow up? Because then we're, and then this gentleman here.
Yeah. You guys shared some interesting databases and websites that I had not heard of. It's really useful. How do you find your most useful databases and websites, and how equally do you make sure that you're not ignoring really important stuff that you have there that you might not know about?
That's always the challenge.
My advice. So when I started this project, and we did Interactive as part of our project, and that we wanted to find evidence from satellite data for deforest contact, but he was a environmental data scientist at the University of Washington, the Landsat data from NASA, the Copernicus data from the European Union, and he walked me through this stuff that I had no idea about, but that was essential to doing satellite data reporting. Another way that that's described is finding your rabbi, finding someone who will actually take the time to explain, find a person, whether it's because of their identity or just because they're interested in your project, or because you did build a rapport with them.
Yeah, thanks. Actually, I should have asked this question earlier, because I know it's not time to answer it. Just a question for any or all of you, and that is, how do you judge the impact that your stories have in terms of whether they actually lead to action or change or, you know, no more offshore, you know, havens, things like that? And to what extent do you feel the journalist should be concerned about that or actively try to, you know?
So we don't do things to, you know, to change, to have an agenda to change things, but we also investigate something because we think it's not working properly, it's not protecting people that should protect. So I think one way is to, when people, including legislators or other kind of third parties, start talking about your story, that's good, because at least you have informed them, and then they can take action and, you know, take the story to the next level. Obviously, that you don't need to get to the level, even just having, you know, activists.
Cool. And as to the sorts of areas worth investigating and what you hope to accomplish.
Impact is to obtain a particular policy outcome or, you know, get a certain person in trouble, but that you want to see the world reacting to the story. I think that one important indication of impact is that when people who questions or confront the people who are responsible for the status quo with how the system isn't working, in a way that they are unable to defend their lack of action, that is a good catalyst for change. Partly because it shames them, but partly because if they do really care about doing their jobs well, they'll realize that.
I just wanted to add that, there's a government who is pro-report about this, you know. Government in action, you know, is what you already have, and that doesn't mean you shouldn't document things for the future. So I think we shouldn't be discouraged if we don't have an impact. We should, you know, we're building knowledge there, so I think that's important too.
That is a perfect closing thought. Thank you, and I guess off to lunch. Bon appetit.